Of chapter 11, and this is all part of the last vision of the book. And so chapter 10 is basically preparatory for the vision, but within the preparation, there's another sort of vision and of an individual, not specifically indicating who it is, but we want to, again, look back at this and also be reminded that the final three chapters, chapters 10, 11, and 12, are the culmination of the book of Daniel, and it is basically building on the visions of those occasions that have happened prior to this and giving further detail toward what is coming in the future. So we had previously seen that Daniel was a captive Israelite youth, and he got a great promotion. He was turned to a valuable administrator through various administrations and served in a high capacity in the area of Babylon and in Persia. And so this was kind of a big deal. For unstated reasons, God chose Daniel to be the instrument of revelation for many of the important future details to come, which is interesting to think about. Well, Daniel was essentially an administrator. Why is he given this incredible opportunity to function in this capacity? And I think we see when we look at his life, it was because he was wholeheartedly devoted to the Lord in the midst of some most demanding situations, kind of like a period of time we can relate to now in our world and culture, where the situations are very difficult, where there is a greater pagan influence, and he was standing firm in the middle of that. Also, as we think about the basic order of things here, the first chapter of this section that we're looking at introduces the vision or the revelation that's given of what is going to follow, but it includes a little part of a vision as well. And there are two parts to the vision that's coming. The immediate future from Darius through Antiochus that we have previously referenced. This will be more detail in chapter 11, verse 2 through 35. And then the second part, there is going to be dealing with the more distant future associated with the 70th week that was brought up in Daniel chapter 9, and it's going to be dealing with the tribulation period, and that is chapter 11, verse 36 through 12:4. That's just to sort of give a little bit of an overview of where we are headed with these details. Then the rest of chapter 12 provides a conclusion to this revelation. But today our focus is going to be predominantly on chapter 10 and looking at just a quick review of the first part and then looking at verse 15 through chapter 11, verse 4. So for our review, there's a general context for receiving another revelation. There's a whole chapter on this, and so it's kind of giving us some insight into how Daniel was dealing with this on a personal level and what the context was where this was going on. Just to have a quick review of leading into this chapter, again, in the third year of Cyrus, this is verse 1 of chapter 10, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel. And so this is kind of leading into it, whose name was called Belshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. And so this is sort of leading into, but I'm going to do a quick review of what we had previously looked at. There was a specific background for the vision. The reference to Cyrus gives a time frame and a geographical context. We're talking about Babylon. This is about 536 BC. The reference to Daniel indicates his direct personal connection to this situation, and so he was experiencing this as well as recording and communicating it. There was personal preparation for the vision. Daniel was involved in matter of fasting and prayer, and so this was something of the state of mind. He was thinking about what was going on in his world around him and the impact on his people. That was kind of weighty on him. In light of the visions that he had had prior to this, was all somewhat background. And then there's a reference to a time frame, 3 weeks. Obviously, this was literal weeks of days that was included here. And it's Passover, the time frame when this fits in the calendar was just following the celebration of the Passover and the special time that that was. So that might have been also preparatory for his thinking in terms of the Lord's previous deliverance in days past. There was an unusual visual manifestation. This is sort of a vision within the preparation for the actual vision that's coming. A specific time and place are indicated here. He's at the Tigris River, and then he encounters a brilliant manifestation. Now, the question is, well, who is this manifestation that he's seeing? And we're not going to take the time to go into all the details here, but just a reminder, there's some parallels to what Daniel is seeing here to what the Apostle John saw in the book of Revelation chapter 1. And so some have speculated, well, was this a pre-incarnate manifestation of Christ? Or was this just another brilliant angel? And it's uncertain, but we would see that if this vision was of the pre-incarnate Christ, then it wouldn't be the same angel that was referenced later that was needing help from Michael. So there may be more than one angel that is in view, or if it's not Christ, it could potentially be the same angel. So you'll have to kind of, I'm going to urge you to go back and read that, see if you can sort that out for yourself and make some definitive conclusions, though I've read it and I haven't come to a definitive conclusion, so I'll just tell you that. There was selectivity in the reception of the vision. He was with some others. They didn't see the vision, though they had a sense that something was going on that was kind of a major, and they ran and hid. The reception of this vision was limited to Daniel. This encounter left Daniel in a weakened state. He is just feeling drained from what he had just observed in this angelic manifestation, whether it was the angel of the Lord, speaking of pre-incarnate presentation of Christ, or whether it was some other angelic manifestation. Like one of the living creatures that Ezekiel saw in his encounter, or later on in the book of Revelation as well. Then there's verbal encouragement before the vision, and just another quick look at some of the text, verses 10 through 12. Suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands, and he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling. Then he said to me, Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. That seems to indicate something of the nature of Daniel's response in relationship with the Lord, and that's why I think he was the one that was chosen for this particular incredible amount of revelation that he is given in this book to communicate. So there was an angelic word of personal encouragement. The presence of another angel was disturbing. We see multiple occasions whenever an angel shows up, people fear, and the angel says, "Fear not," because it disturbs them, as I would think we would be as well. The response of fear prompted further angelic encouragement. And so because he was in a state of mind of having an element of receptivity, and yet the manifestation that comes before him is overwhelming, and then he needs some encouragement. And this is still prior to the major amount of revelation that's coming. There was an explanation of the delay in response, and this is really interesting when you look at the text here, because the angel was delayed in coming 3 weeks. This verse provides some insight into the unseen world. There was spiritual warfare going on that impacted the function of this angel to the degree that this angel was not able to come to the aid of and the response to Daniel in the time frame that was initially anticipated. This is a clear indication of the conflict behind the scenes. That is, there is a spiritual realm that we can't see where angelic and demonic activity is going on. That's what we saw when we were looking at that text previously, and just a reminder now. This was all preparatory to the vision about to be revealed. So this good angel had come to Daniel to explain what would happen to the Jews in the latter days that were yet future. Daniel had already received some revelation about what lay ahead, chapter 8, chapter 9, that we had previously observed. And it was evidently this revelation that got him thinking and somewhat puzzled as to how this is going to work out. What are the implications for his people? And so he's kind of looking for some clarification and wanting to know more. How is this all going to come to pass? What's going to be the impact on his people? Daniel, as we had noted, is already in his 80s at this time, so he's thinking, well, his time may be done, but what about his people who are still going to be around? So what follows then in chapter 11 is more information on those things that had been previously introduced. So just as chapter 8, verses 23 to 26, and chapter 9, 24 to 27, chapter 11, 2 through 12, 4 are going to contain information about Israel's fate relative to the impact of Antiochus Epiphanes in the near future, but also it's going to be dealing with information regarding Israel's fate in the more distant future as it relates to the Antichrist in the tribulation period. So that's all being communicated here. And that is why it has often been said you shouldn't study the book of Revelation until you've had a good look at the book of Daniel, because it's giving the background for what is communicated. So that catches us up from last time to then move on to part two that we're looking at today. So the verbal encouragement before the vision is going to continue, but this is the personal response to the preparations for the vision. So this is the personal response to the preparations for the vision. Looking at the text in chapter 10, verses 15 through 17, we read, "When he had spoken such words to me, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. And suddenly, one having the likeness of the sons of men touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke, saying to him who stood before me, 'My Lord, because of the vision, my sorrows have overwhelmed me, and I have retained no strength.'" So this is, again, another time, second time that he is communicating his loss of strength and his inability to really function and trying to process all that's going on. There in verse 17, "And how can this servant of my Lord talk with you, my Lord? As for me, no strength remains in me now, nor is there any breath left in me." So he's somewhat overwhelmed at what he's dealing with. There was an acknowledgement of personal weakness. The previous angelic encounter left Daniel speechless. What he had observed and what he is thinking through and trying to process is somewhat overwhelming to him. And probably the angel's explanation about the angelic conflict that had just been previously referenced seems to be something that Daniel had no knowledge of. This was completely news to him. And his only reaction to that information, plus the vision that he had just seen of the brilliant being, was to bow his head and silently accept the revelation. And it was weighty. I mean, it was heavy to him. He sensed a need to admit his physical weakness to the angel. Now, if we had been there, we might have been at a loss for words and couldn't really think of what to say. And so it's like, okay, I feel kind of wiped out from all this, and that's about the best you can come up with. What would you do, and what would you be feeling like? So the one who is communicated here as resembling a human being seems to be an angel, again, who touched his lips and thereby enabled him to speak. The prophet sort of proceeded to explain to the angel that the vision had left him in a state of anxiety and had basically robbed him of his strength. And it kind of reminds us of what the response that Isaiah had in Isaiah chapter 6 when he had a similar kind of encounter with an angelic manifestation and a recognition of the holiness of God. So he indicated that he felt inferior to this angel, like, I don't deserve to even speak with you. He felt unworthy. And I think that's, from what we see in Scripture, a common occurrence. So when we have a point of contact with someone or something that is more holy, it leaves us feeling unholy. It leaves us feeling unworthy. And how much occasion do we have in our world today to even have that sense of being in the presence of holiness? I don't know if we have that sense. Where would we go? How would we think about encountering something like an angel who comes and goes from the presence of God, or being in the presence of God? How would we feel? What would be our response in a similar kind of situation? Because it reminds us of the fact that we are sinful, fallen human beings, and we end up seeing how short we come to the expectations that God has in light of who He is and what He is like. So I think it's only reasonable that we would have a similar kind of response. But where do we get that in our world today? Do we have that same kind of thing? I mean, the major disposition that people have today is of their personal autonomy. It all revolves around me. I don't care about anybody else. If it impacts me, if it gets in the way of what I want to do, where I want to go, how I want to be, we have a sense of entitlement, all of that. But do we have a sense of unworthiness? I mean, how many times have you encountered somebody who said, you know, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy to be given any consideration. That's not a very common mindset today. And I'm not saying we should just, you know, go around hanging our head and being miserable. I'm just saying, what kind of disposition, attitude ought we to have? Would we have an attitude comparable to what Daniel is communicating here? Interesting thought. Then moving on, verses 18 and 19. Then again, the one having the likeness of a man touched me and strengthened me, and he said, O man, greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be to you. Be strong. Yes, be strong. So when he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. So he's experiencing the very thing that he had a sense of need of. And the angel is responding to him, not saying, well, you are nothing but slime. What were you thinking, even coming into my presence? He's saying, I'm there as an angel to provide assistance and strength for you. So there was a special provision of strength and encouragement. So there is another direct contact from the angel. This is the third instance in this chapter of Daniel receiving strength from an angel who touched him. And I'm reminded of Hebrews chapter 1, 14, where it talks about ministering spirits, which we'll look at a little bit further in a minute. And I'm reminded also of Luke's record of an angel strengthening Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, Luke 22, 39-44. So that's a familiar activity associated with angels. I'm sure there are many times when we would like to have that come to our aid when we're going through difficulty and we'd like to have an angel show up at just the right time. What we don't know is that maybe that does happen in ways we hadn't thought about, which is a possibility. As in, it may be working through some other individual or some other circumstance. The Lord can do that. If an angel had shown up, we would have been afraid anyway. So this human appearing angel was probably the same one who had previously touched Daniel's lips, but it may have been a different one than the one who he had originally seen in that vision. We're just not sure of that. And again, the angel gives him a complimentary description. A reference refers to him as greatly beloved or man of high esteem, as he had previously. So this would have been reassuring to Daniel when he was communicating his sense of being very intimidated in the presence of an angel. And now he's, again, getting some encouragement. So there is this additional word of encouragement here. And he's encouraged to not fear, to be at peace, to take courage, to be courageous. Kind of reminds you of Joshua. When Joshua was given the task of taking over after Moses, and the Lord said to him more than once, take courage, be courageous. In our context today, I think we need that encouragement. There are a lot of things that are discouraging, and we need to take courage. We need to be encouraged as well and realize our strength comes from the Lord as we recognize the occasion where Daniel was being encouraged also. So the total effect of these various verses that indicate something of Daniel's sense of weakness and then the strength that is provided to him, I think helps us to recognize the anticipation that is building for the revelation that is about to be given. That it's, I think, communicating, this is important stuff. This is something that's important enough to go through all of this preparatory experience that Daniel is going through, to say this is something of some great significance. You don't want to miss this. And it's also been recognized that the vision that follows in chapter 11, verse 2 through 12, 4, is the most detailed prophetic revelation in the book of Daniel, because it's going to go into more of the previous occasions had been more summary, and then it sort of gets then into more detail. And that's kind of been the way it's been. You get a bit of an overview, and then it kind of expands and builds on that. So the last couple of verses of chapter 10 and then the first verse of chapter 11. Then he said, "Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia, and when I have gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth." The writings of truth, maybe another way of putting it. No one upholds me except these, against these, except Michael, your prince. So he's saying, in dealing with this opposition, Michael at least is there to be of assistance to him. And then you notice where the parentheses begins there. And then it's going to go all the way to the end, and you can't tell me that I don't have the numbers in that. I'll have it more paragraph form on your the text up here. But this parentheses, this is all together. If you miss this as the chapter division, and when somebody put that chapter division in place, and those are not inspired by any means. Those are an after thing just for help. The chapter division should have come here, because this is together with, this is what the angel is communicating here. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen. That's not Daniel talking. That's the angel talking, what he was doing previous. Because otherwise it could cause you to think, well, this is the introduction to another vision here. So there was an explanation of the purpose for this contact, or at least an inquiry relative to it. The angel inquired of Daniel about his purpose in coming. The angel asked if Daniel knew why he had come to him. And Daniel may have been processing that, trying to think, well, there's got to be a good reason. Angels don't just show up for no reason. And he apparently did this to help focus Daniel's attention on what was coming, so that in spite of his being in somewhat of a weakened state, he can be anticipating revelation that is about to be given to him. The angel indicated his need to fight demonic oppression. And that's an interesting observation as well. The angel informed Daniel that he had to return to resume fighting against the demon who was influencing Persia, and then battle the one that would be influencing Greece. The reference to the prince of Greece may be referring to the... assumed that it may be a reference to a demonic individual who was going to be controlling the person in Greece who was in leadership. That would have been referring to or anticipating Alexander the Great in the context, as we will see. And also, we recognize that Persia and Greece are the two kingdoms that have been the focus of prophecy in this book. Going back to chapter 2 in the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, chapter 7 in the dream that Daniel had of some of the same kingdoms, and then chapter 8 and chapter 9 again expanded on those, and chapter 11 is going to do so as well. So behind the many details of prophecy relating to the history of this period, there's an unseen struggle of angelic forces that have to do with God's will being accomplished but it's not without conflict, not without struggle. Kind of interesting. We have maybe a picture in our mind that things just go in a certain way and it's sort of automatic. But this is indicating there's warfare going on behind the scenes, in this context at the very least, and probably in others. And it makes you wonder, well, what was going on, if you want to just project it to the immediate situation, what was going on in Afghanistan? Was there some kind of angelic, demonic activity going on behind that? Where's that going to go? How is that going to impact things? Well, we don't really know. But it does make you wonder. The phrase "scripture of truth" seems to indicate all that God has recorded as truth. It would certainly include scripture. It may include other truth that God may not have yet directly revealed. But this angel is communicating to Daniel that there is a portion of truth that is now going to be revealed to Daniel. And it is a truth that exists outside of Daniel that he is going to become aware of. And that is going to give him insight relative to what's going to happen to his people and what are things that are yet to come. And that's kind of heavy stuff when you think about it. We have, because we're looking back, we have the whole of Revelation, the full canonical books that have been provided for us from Genesis through the book of Revelation. And we have a picture of what is coming. And that can be overwhelming when we look at that. We don't have it all figured out. Not all the details, but as things unfold, we can see things coming together with a little bit more specificity at various times. But you can rest assured, you won't know what you're not supposed to know until you know it, when you're supposed to know it. So don't rush ahead, but we'll know it when we need it. So be prepared for that. The fact that Daniel, Daniel is hearing this presentation about, again, this behind the scenes angelic activity, must have left Daniel, I think, in a state of maybe wonderment of, wow, look at this stuff that's going on. And here is Michael again referenced. That he stood with this angel in this warfare, and I would think that would have been some encouragement to Daniel. And Michael is referred to in the presence of Daniel as your prince, and that's been associated with he's the angel who has responsibility in some specific way to Israel. In light of that. And so he seems to be commissioned, particularly in this case, to help his Jewish brethren. And so that would be encouraging to realize that there's stuff going on behind the scenes, but there's an angelic presence there to assist in our favor. Now, we've read Ephesians chapter 6. We have a sense that there's warfare going on. There are different levels of demonic activity that we have to contend with, but there are also different levels of angelic individuals who are there to serve us as well. So that's heavy stuff. I mean, Daniel was a little weighed down by it, and I suspect if we think about it enough without going too far into it, we would realize, wow, that is kind of heavy stuff to have to deal with. So I think it's encouraging for God's people to know that there are these angelic beings who are working in our behalf to defend the saints against the attacks of the evil one. And again, Hebrews 1:14 says, "Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister to those who will inherit salvation?" So there is a service in the angelic realm toward our benefit. Then the last note here, verse 1 of chapter 11 actually concludes chapter 10. That would be the better way of having divided that up. Again, the chapter verse divisions are an addition that came much later after the text was received. The NASB, the NIV, the New King James translators tried to bring some clarity by the parenthetical note there that ties verse 21 through verse 1 of chapter 11. And if you don't make that observation, then you can kind of come to a conclusion that we're getting a different vision here, because it's it could be perceived as a marker, but that is not the case. So Daniel is experiencing this preparatory angelic manifestation and communication, just getting him ready for the vision. Now that's kind of interesting that much is going on here. So now moving then to the last section. The historical context for new revelation. "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings." This is the beginning of the actual revelation. We just have, because this is review of some other things, we're just going to barely get started here. "Now I tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece." So we're talking specific nations and reference to various kings here. So there will be four future kings of the kingdom of Persia. And this is, again, more history, historical kind of stuff that's communicated here. The vision begins with four future kings of Persia. And the first part of what's communicated here is preparatory to the Messiah's first advent, his first coming. And then the latter part that's going to be committed is preparatory to his second coming. So we need to think about it in terms of why this came now, because it's anticipating the Messiah's coming. This is some of the important revelation in preparation for the Messiah's first advent that's taking place here. So Daniel learned that four more Persian kings would arise after Darius. And these, of course, we're going to wonder, which ones are we talking about here? Well, they have been identified as Cambyses and Pseudo-Smerdis, also known as Gautama or Gaumata, and Bardia. Those are different names for this Pseudo-Smerdis. And then also one is recognized as Darius the First or Darius the Great. And then there's a fourth Persian king that became stronger than his predecessors, and he was going to attack Greece. That has been associated with Xerxes the First, or also known as Ahasuerus. And I'm not going to take the time to go into the details of the history of that, but he's been recognized as Xerxes of attacking Greece in 480 with a huge army, but he ultimately suffered defeat and was not able to win that battle. So this seems to be the best recognition of who these kings were, looking at the historical context of what has come since then. Then looking at verses 3 and 4 of chapter 11, "Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled." Now that's kind of important there, not among his posterity. In other words, he was not going to determine who was going to take his place. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. So there will be a rise and fall of another great kingdom. The mighty king who arose and did as he pleased proved to be Alexander the Great. We have some familiarity with him. He was known as Alexander the Third of Macedon, but commonly became known as Alexander the Great over time as history has evaluated him. His invasion of the Persian Empire was in large part a retaliation against Xerxes' previous attacks of his people. And he first attacked the Persians at the Granicus River near Constantinople in 334 BC, and then finally overthrew the Persians at Gaugamela near Nineveh in 331 BC, in case you want the historical details of that. But it only took him 5 years to conquer the greater part of the then western area of the world. And that's why he was given that name, because he was able to do that rather quickly. The quick rise of Alexander was followed by his premature death. He did not live very long. I think he was only in his early 30s. And he died prematurely in Babylon, which he had been using as his imperial capital. And it's interesting, he was taking on more Persian persona, and some of his Macedonian generals and so on were getting kind of upset that he was moving in that direction. He died in 323 BC. His two sons, Hercules and Alexander, were both murdered when they were very young, and his uncle was also killed. His name was Philip. And so Alexander's kingdom was eventually divided among his four leading generals, Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. And then it didn't have the same power that it had previously had. So all of that had been predicted, and history has shown that to be how it had turned out. So again, this is all the background and the beginning of the vision. It kind of picks up some of the detail that had been revealed previously, and then it's going to move forward and expand further. Why is this important? Why is this communicated in Scripture? Who cares about these four particular kings or Alexander the Great? Well, one of the reasons we care is because of the impact that Alexander the Great had on all of this area relative to the preparation for Christ's coming and the spread of the gospel. The New Testament was communicated in Greek. Why Greek? Well, because Alexander the Great had been there and communicated, spread the Greek language and culture, and so it was accepted so that when Paul was going to be the missionary to the Gentiles, he had a place to go. It was all prepared for him. So is Alexander the Great important? Yeah, the Lord used him. This was prophesied, so it was all really preparatory. So when Paul says in Galatians 4:4, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, as part of the fullness of time. You could also bring in Rome and all the things that Rome had done prior, after Alexander and prior to Christ's coming, to prepare the roads and the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, all of that, again, is part of the stage. So, again, this is preparing the way, communicating what is going to be happening, and we're looking back at all that has been done, and what we see is the Lord is working through his people to accomplish his will and his plan, and he's using people functioning in their own free will to bring about what he wants to have take place. So we can trust him for what is yet going to take place as well.